Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 16. A Small Beginning. When Mary decided to leave the Wentworths at Stoughton, her thoughts naturally turned to Amesbury and Sarah Bagley. In the old Bagley homestead, with Sarah as an eager student, she had known a peace and understanding to which she had long been a stranger. And the two women had corresponded frequently while Mary was away. Sarah evidently wrote that she was more interested than ever in Mary's teaching, and that she and young Richard Kennedy spent much time in studying the manuscripts which Mary had left with them. None of the correspondence has been preserved, but it would seem more than likely that as Mary recounted to Sarah the growing difficulties of her position in the Wentworth household, Sarah would urge her to return to Amesbury, assuring her of a warm welcome in her home. At any rate, Mary did not hesitate. She went straight from Stoughton to Amesbury, arriving there in the early fall of 1869. To her, it was something more of a homecoming than she had known for many years. She had been a welcome guest in many households through her long period of wandering, but in coming back to Sarah Bagley, she could feel that she was not only welcomed, but needed, that she had a real opportunity for service and for furthering the great purpose which, about this time, was beginning to take definite shape in her thought. For it would seem clear from what follows that it was while she was at Amesbury on the second visit that Mary Patterson began definitely to emerge from the borderland of half-light, in which she had lived for so long, into a mental realm where more confident advance was possible. While she was at the Wentworths, she had completed a manuscript which she entitled The Science of Man, and had allowed Mrs. Wentworth to make a copy of it. This copy is still preserved, and apart from its contents, reveals two points of special interest. She still loyally attributes the teaching it presents to Quimby, and yet so unceasing is the development of her own concept that she cannot even leave Mrs. Wentworth's manuscript alone after she has copied it, but must needs change it to bring it into line with her own changing thought. There is no mistaking Mary's characteristic handwriting as seen in the corrections and interlineations. Writing of these days many years afterwards in her book Science and Health, Mrs. Eddy tells how, when Christian Science was a fresh revelation to the author, she had to impart, while teaching its grand facts, the hue of spiritual ideas from her own spiritual condition, and she had to do this orally through the meager channel afforded by language and by her manuscript circulated among the students. And then she adds, and this illustrates the point in question, that as former beliefs were gradually expelled from her thought, the teaching became clearer, until finally, the shadow of old errors was no longer cast upon divine science. Any comparison of this Wentworth manuscript with the Quimby manuscripts, which were eventually published in 1921, shows that while the language is often much the same, there is clearly here emerging that fundamental doctrine of Christian Science which differentiates it from all other interpretations, namely, the unreality of matter from the standpoint of spirit. This is a doctrine Quimby never affirmed, and one that Julius Dresser and others of his immediate followers always repudiated. It is this teaching and its involvements which must, of course, enter more and more into the warp and weft of the story from now on. It will be found, before long, challenging thought in all directions, and whatever the view of it may be, transforming the lives and the outlook of many people. The moment this demand, the unreality of matter, and consequently the unreality of all matter's manifestations, including disease and death, is imported into the teaching of Quimby, thence onwards, the only relation between the old and new theories is the relation between Ptolemaic and the Copernican theories of the universe. Copernicus did not, and of course could not, disregard the Ptolemaic literature of the heavens. But he could render it all obsolete by the simple demonstration that the earth moved around the sun and not the sun around the earth. Quimby declared that mind was stronger than matter, and that through certain strange and devious methods, this could be practically demonstrated. Mary Patterson, in the manuscript she gave to Mrs. Wentworth, is rapidly reaching the point where she sees that mind can overcome matter and all materiality in the human consciousness. Not because mind is stronger than matter and all materiality, but because mind is the only reality, and matter and all materiality are in the realms of illusion. As she often put it, in effect, later on, matter, like 2 + 2 = 5, is not, but seemeth to be. All of which is, of course, to run ahead of the record, but some such digression is perhaps necessary to render intelligible the almost cyclonic movements which are to take place in the near future. Meanwhile, Mary Patterson, like a passenger on board a boat crossing the horizon as seen from the shore, is quite unaware of anything out of the ordinary happening. She comes back to Sarah Bagley with her familiar bundle of papers, now much bulkier than when she had left Amesbury some 2 years before, and gets down to work at once. The fall and winter which followed seem to have been, for Mary, one of the few oases of peace and tranquility in her long life. It was the calm before another storm, more tempestuous than any before. But while the quiet lasted, it must have been strangely welcome. Miss Bagley, like the good New England spinster that she was essentially a homemaker. She had a place for everything, and everything was in its place. In this, she and Mary were very profoundly in agreement. Years afterwards, in the great house on Chestnut Hill, careful servants on cleaning days would put thumbtacks in the carpets so that they might return each piece of furniture to its exact position in Mrs. Eddy's study. Then Sarah Bagley had a new interest in life. In the evenings, when young Richard Kennedy came round and the three would sit and talk and read together, Sarah no longer watched the clock so as to be ready to move on her way upstairs the moment it pointed to 10:15. Already, both she and Dick, as she always called him, had had some success in helping sick people, and they were eager to learn more of the means by which it could be done. Mary, too, was more sure of herself. The one thing that had always troubled her about Quimby's healing, or rather Quimby's attitude towards it, was his often expressed uncertainty as to how it was done. From the first, she was confident that if it was done at all, there must be a discoverable way by which it was done. Quimby, however, as has already been noted, was not so sure, and was at times inclined to believe that the power was in him and might perish with him. Every day was now affording Mary proof that even if she had not discovered Quimby's way of healing the sick, she had nonetheless discovered a way, and that she could pass on the knowledge as to how it was done to others. So the winter passed happily and profitably, and as the spring came on, the question as to what should be the next move seems to have come up for discussion among the three. By this time, Richard Kennedy, who was a distant relative of Miss Bagley by marriage, had moved over to the Bagley house, and so eager and interested was he in his new studies that it began to be a question with him whether he should not give up his work of making boxes and devote himself instead to the work of healing. He was only 21, but in those days, everyone started out on their life's work earlier than they do today, and to be a full-fledged doctor in practice at 21 was not at all uncommon. Mary Patterson seems to have been rightly doubtful about the move. But as spring merged into summer, the idea took more definite shape, until at last it was decided that Mary and Dick should move to Lynn, that Dick should set up as a doctor, taking an office and keeping regular hours, while Mary devoted herself to teaching, much the same as the arrangement followed with the Crafts at Taunton. Before the actual move was made, Mary had an interesting experience, which must have gone a long way towards confirming her and her two faithful friends in the feasibility of the plans they were working out. One very hot day in early summer, Sarah came to Mary and asked her if she would not go with her to visit her old friend Whittier, who had lately suffered the loss of a much-loved sister and was himself far from well. Mary readily agreed, and it was not long before the two women reached the large gabled house under the elms which Whittier had built for himself some 30 years before. They found the poet sitting before a large fire, with flushed cheeks and coughing painfully. He greeted his visitors with what graciousness he could muster. But when Sarah asked him what on earth he wanted with a fire on such a hot day. He answered irritably, with the liberty of an old friend, that he had the fire because he was cold, and that if Jesus Christ lived in Amesbury, he would need brass-lined lungs to survive. This was all that Mary needed. She sailed right in. There is, unfortunately, no record of what she said. But as Whittier listened to her with growing interest, Sarah noticed that he stopped coughing, and that the flush left his cheek, and that he moved away from the fire. Within a little while, all his gloom was gone, and when his visitors rose to go, he took both of Mary's hands in his, and said eagerly, "I thank thee, Mary, for thy call. It has done me much good. Come again." Whether she ever did go again is not recorded, but professionally it was not necessary, for next day Whittier was out and about, completely recovered. It was not long after this incident that Mary and Richard Kennedy set out for Lynn. Sarah must have been sad to see them go, but she herself was rapidly making new friends with her healing work. She kept it up with profit to herself and varying success until she died some 20 years later. But she was one of the first of a long succession of students of this new teaching who never advanced in thought beyond the point at which they entered. When Mary Patterson taught Sarah what she knew at that date, her teaching was still mixed up with the mesmerism and manipulation of Quimby's doctrine. She herself was to leave it entirely behind, but Sarah Bagley never did. It was early in the summer of 1870 when Mary and Richard Kennedy arrived in Lynn. They went first of all to the house of a Mrs. Clarkson Oliver, a friend who had formerly lived in Amesbury. She received them gladly, and next day Richard went in search of suitable quarters wherein to set out on the new adventure. It was some time before he could find just what he wanted, but finally, towards evening, at the corner of Shepherd and South Common Streets, he came upon a large 3-story house, standing a little back from the street. In front of it was displayed a notice to the effect that there was established a private school for young children, that the principal was Miss Susie Magoon, and that the second floor, which comprised 5 rooms, was for rent to a suitable tenant. It seemed to Richard just what he was looking for, and within a few minutes, he was talking to Miss Susie Magoon herself, explaining his mission. He was seeking offices for a physician, with sleeping quarters adjoining, and had seen the notice that the second floor was to let, and thought it might be suitable. Miss Magoon, contemplating the boyish figure before her, not unnaturally assumed that the physician in question was his father, but nonetheless readily acquiesced when Richard somewhat diffidently explained that he was the physician, and that he wanted the rooms for himself and an elderly woman who was writing a book. Miss Magoon had, it transpired, only recently opened the school, and she was eager to have her second floor rented, as she herself occupied the third. Within a few days, all the necessary agreements as to rent and notice having been arranged, Mary Patterson and Richard Kennedy moved into their new quarters. And next morning, on a tree outside the front door, appeared a sign bearing the simple legend, Dr. Kennedy. The reasons for success are often difficult of discovery and still more difficult of just appraisal. But in the case of Richard Kennedy, the cause of his success, for he was, from the first, extraordinarily successful, is simple enough. He did what he said he would do. He healed the sick. The sign on the tree outside Miss Magoon's school brought in one or two curious people almost the first day. They may have gone in idle curiosity, but they came out enthusiastic, self-appointed publicity agents for the new doctor and his new theory of medicine. One grateful patient passed on the good news to another, and it was not long before Richard had a large and thriving practice. Then, quite a number of his patients desired to know and to learn more of the theory, and it was here that Mary Patterson took up the work. At first, she talked to each one separately, as she had been doing now for a number of years. But after a time, she came to see that if she was to carry on the work to the best advantage and make her just contribution to the partnership which existed between her and young Richard, she would have to work out some way of teaching more than just one person at a time. Richard could charge a regular fee for a definite service rendered, but there seemed to Mary no way in which half an hour's talk could be evaluated, and she apparently shrank from making the attempt. If, however, she were to form a class, give people an outline of what they might expect to learn, fix the number of lessons to be given, and charge a certain definite fee, it would place the whole enterprise on an intelligible basis and open the way for sound development. She decided upon this course. The great problem was one of fees. Limited as her experience so far had been, Mary Patterson had evidently learned the lesson that the human mind never values highly what it secures easily and cheaply. She must already have been familiar with the type of mind that came to her on the basis that it would cost nothing, could do no harm, and might do some good. And she must often have seen the sorry results of such an attitude. And so she took what was to prove a momentous decision. She was dealing, for the most part, with working people, almost all of them connected in varying capacities with the shoe industry. Their average wage would probably have been considerably less than $1,000 a year. And yet, she decided on a fee of $300 for a course of 12 lessons. This fee was never changed. Years afterwards, when she had secured a charter for a college of her own, carrying with it the right to confer diplomas and degrees, the fee for instruction, $300, remained the same. Writing of it in her book retrospection and introspection, Mrs. Eddy says, I could think of no financial equivalent for an impartation of a knowledge of that divine power which heals. But I was led to name $300 as the price for each pupil in one course of lessons at my college. A startling sum for tuition lasting barely 3 weeks. She often, as will be seen, received students for nothing, often remitted part of the fees, but in the final settlement, she always gave them a receipt in full. The fee was $300. To those who desired to pay but could not, she was notable in her consideration and forbearance. But to those who had taken what she had to give, who could pay and would not, she was unremitting in her demands that the obligation be met. And so the work got underway, and the first class was formed. It was a strangely mixed and strangely troubled gathering. Perhaps the best view of it is obtained from the account preserved by one of its members, Samuel Putnam Bancroft, who in 1920 published his recollections of those early days of the Christian Science movement, together with some interesting original documents, in a book entitled Mrs. Eddy as I Knew Her in 1870. Putney Bancroft, as he was known to his friends, was a young shoe operative, a foreman in the factory of Bancroft and Purrington in Lynn. And he recounts how one evening in the fall of 1870, he received an unexpected call from a young man under his supervision in the factory named Daniel H. Spofford and his wife. They seemed very full of something, and after the usual greetings, Mrs. Spofford plunged at once into the subject, telling him of a remarkable woman, a Mrs. Patterson, lately come to Lynn, who was teaching a new method of healing the sick, and that this woman had a young man with her, a Dr. Richard Kennedy, who was treating patients with great success. That Mrs. Spofford had been treated by him and had been greatly benefited, and had now enrolled herself in a class just being formed by Mrs. Patterson for the purpose of giving instruction in her method so convincingly demonstrated by the young doctor. Mrs. Spofford urged Putney Bancroft to join. And after some further discussion, Bancroft was so impressed that he asked Mrs. Spofford to arrange an interview for him with Mrs. Patterson. They met soon afterwards, and Bancroft found everything as Mrs. Spofford had said. I was greatly pleased with the lady, he writes, and favorably impressed with her proposition to the extent that I decided to accept it. Among the other members of the class, some of whom were to figure prominently in the events which were to follow, were George W. Berry, a foreman in a workshop, Miss Dorcas Rawson, also a shoe worker, Mrs. Frances Penny, who had a small specialty workshop for women's shoes, George H. Allen, a worker in his father's box factory, George H. Tuttle, a young sailor, Mrs. Miranda Rice, a sister of Miss Rawson, Charles Stanley, Wallace W. Wright, and Mrs. Otis Vickery. The class was held in Mrs. Patterson's rooms over Miss Magoon's school. And in spite of the many difficulties which seemed to have attended its every session, lasted through the full 12 lessons. In word and deed, it illustrated Mrs. Eddy's later contentions that her early teaching was a groping in the dark, and that while the fundamental principle was the same from the beginning, it was so overlaid with the irrelevancies she inherited from Quimby, or her own more orthodox convictions, as to be almost unrecognizable when placed side by side with what she ultimately evolved. Bancroft's brief description and comment present the complete picture. Before studying, he writes, we were treated by Dr. Kennedy in order to render us receptive and to acquaint us with the physical methods used, after which Mrs. Patterson was to teach us the spiritual methods. Dr. Kennedy's treatment consisted of manipulation of the head and solar plexus. The theory, as we understood it, was that these were considered the most sensitive portions of the body. Mrs. Eddy taught us, however, that there was no sensation in matter. To some of us, this seemed a paradox. This paradox, or seeming contradiction of theory, led to many serious complications and brought sorrows to Mrs. Eddy and reproach on her teaching. This she did not realize for some time. As soon as she did, her students were instructed to modify the physical methods and finally to abandon them altogether. In this first class, Dr. Kennedy's energetic preparatory exercises were accepted as a matter of course. But as the class progressed, the argument waxed so vigorous at times that at last Charles Stanley, who seems to have passed all bounds in the matter of criticism, was asked to withdraw. Mary, not unreasonably, insisting that he came there to learn, not to teach. In other words, that he might at least hear the whole story before he began to criticize it. She was, however, eager for questions and discussions. And when Wallace M. Wright presented her with a series of written questions, she answered them fully and carefully in writing. Wallace Wright was perhaps the best educated member of the class. He was the son of a Universalist clergyman and brother of Carol D. Wright, later United States Commissioner of Labor. The questions he submitted are not of sufficient importance to warrant detailed consideration here. They are concerned, for the most part, with side issues, and any points of principle involved must be dealt with later on. Wallace Wright's last question is, however, particularly apposite at this juncture, as showing how loyally, even at this late date, Mary was still attributing her teaching to Quimby. It would not be long before she was to learn from bitter experience the difficulties this would create for her. But for the moment, when Wright asked her, "Has this theory ever been advertised or practiced before you introduced it, or by any other individual?" she answered faithfully, "Never advertised, and practiced by only one individual who healed me, Dr. Quimby of Portland, Maine, an old gentleman who made it a research for 25 years, starting from the standpoint of magnetism, thence going forward and leaving that behind. I discovered the art in a moment's time, and he acknowledged it to me. He died shortly after, and since then, 8 years, I have been founding and demonstrating the science. How little the good Dr. Quimby had really left magnetism behind in his teaching, Mary was to learn through much tribulation within a few short months of making this statement. Meanwhile, the class labored along. Mary had made elaborate preparation for it. Not only did she give to each of its members a manuscript copy of The Science of Man, the manuscript which she had permitted Mrs. Wentworth to copy, but she also wrote specially for this class two other pamphlets, The Soul's Inquiry of Man and Spiritualism and Individuality. All are published by Bancroft in his book from his original manuscript, and taken together, they provide an excellent summary of Mrs. Eddy's teaching in 1870, some 5 years before the publication of Science and Health. Mary Patterson was, as Bancroft affirms, a faithful teacher. Although the course consisted nominally of 12 lessons, she taught any student who seemed to need it between lessons, and continued to instruct them afterwards. "We were never really graduated," he wrote. "Every meeting with her was a lesson, every letter received from her." This continued for years.